My name is Mike Lorenz. I'm an alcoholic. And wow, what a wonderful weekend this has been. And the level of sharing has been just stunning. And it's different. I've attended this conference since the very first one, and it's been a special event every year. And to now to get to participate with a lot of people who have been my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous is a real privilege and an honor, and to share myself with you. Somebody was asking me as I came in this morning how I was feeling, and I thought since I was talking on the 10th and 11th step, I ought to tell the truth. So I said, well, the fear wave's coming, and that happens all the time. But I understand it's just ego, so we'll jump up on the wave and see where we go this morning. I guess I'll start with a story. One of the things, by the way, I want to say thank Bob for doing this, because what this is for me is it's a family reunion. And I didn't know my family was this big for a lot of years. I'd go to the people that were, I'll reference some people that have been my teachers along the way, and understand I've had one sponsor, but that sponsor allows me to have as many teachers and mentors as I need. Anytime I need to learn something new, I don't need to fire my sponsor and get a new one. I simply have a teacher, and my sponsor says, if you learn something good, please share it with me. And that's worked for us for more than 20 years, and I dearly love and honor him. My dry date's September 7th, 1985. That shocked everybody in my area because I was not on the list of most likely to succeed. I have a special passion for what I'm going to talk about today, because I'm one of those that nearly died in Alcoholics Anonymous, further from a drink than I ever expected to be. Getting ready to celebrate my fifth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, and have on paper having everything I needed, thought I ever needed or wanted, and everything else, and only one thing missing. I was just completely hollow inside. I was dying of untreated alcoholism, sitting in 10 or 11 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week, and that wasn't the fault of the meetings I went to. What I'd done is I did in Alcoholics Anonymous approximately what I did years ago when I went to the University of Iowa. I went over to the field house, I signed up for all my classes, went down to the bookstore and bought my books, joined a fraternity, threw the books in the closet, and started partying. And if you ran into me on campus and asked me what I was doing, I would tell you, well, I'm a pre-law student, sir, here at the University of Iowa. And that was technically true, except I rarely went to class. And what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous was I went to every meeting I could get my hands on. I did what every good junior guru does. I started my own meeting because nobody else's was really adequate. And I never missed a dance, I never missed a function, I never missed a party. What I missed was the recovery program in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the fellowship loved me and held me up so well that I made it 5 years that just on that momentum. The miracle of 5 years, I don't want to drink, but I do want to die. I'm thinking, now here's a spiritual thought. Celebrate your fifth anniversary in AA by trying to figure out how you can kill yourself so it won't embarrass the people you sponsor. This is not a vision for you. And who knew? The man I disliked most in Alcoholics Anonymous was the guy that was the channel of the solution that ended up saving my life and giving it purpose and meaning and direction. And like everybody, when I find a solution, I grasp it, and I go through an evangelical period, you know, and I'm very tightly focused on what I've learned and the miracle of all of that. And if you don't do it my way, you're wrong. And I spent a period of time, and thank God another teacher came along and grabbed me the mic, and he said, those people aren't wrong. They're successful what they do. What they have is they have a different style than you and I do. And they're members of our family too, and you need to honor them. And so I love it that I get to come together on a weekend like this where I hear other members of my family, some of them with different styles from mine, and I get to benefit and learn from all of you. So thank you so much for what you've given me this weekend. Mother, I always liked the quote from Mother Teresa. Somebody asked her what it was like now that she had become enlightened. And she says, oh, well, that's simple. She says, before I was enlightened, I looked down on people. And now that I'm enlightened, I look down on people that look down on people. And and I love that because it lightened it up. It's a reminder to me that I'm not going to arrive, and I don't need to worry about arriving. What I need to do is learn to enjoy the journey. This journey for me has been a constant process of finding and discarding old ideas. My friend Clint, I used to love it. He and his wife had a thing. Honey, why don't we just spend a day this day and see if we can find an old idea and get rid of it? What a wonderful way to enhance the quality of your life. And so one of my old ideas is that, I've got a whole collection of spiritual awakenings were going to feel good. The problem with spiritual awakening is they involve the disappointment of my ego. I mean, my ego really believes that it could kill me and go on living all by itself. And it was mentioned yesterday several times by several of our speakers, you know, the price I pay for image, ego, whatever you want to. If I look at all those stacks of inventory, if I didn't care about my ego, you know, what would this look like? And so I keep remembering that old Chinese proverb that it's impossible to save face and ass at the same time. You've got to make a choice. And so we do around here. I was really blessed the first couple years. I didn't find this conference, actually. My fiance, sweet Linda, did. And she was in contact with Bob and heard about this conference, and she said, let's go there for this weekend. That's a place where neither one of us will have to do anything, and we can just sit back and be together and have an AA weekend together. And so we began coming here. June of 2007, I went out to Santa Fe to see some friends and do some AA and everything else. And Linda lived, we hadn't gotten married yet, and so she lived over on the west side of town near the airport. And so I took my car over to her place and dropped it off with her in the morning before my flight to Santa Fe. And I parked the car in her garage, and she gave me a ride to the airport. And I took off for Santa Fe and had a wonderful time in Santa Fe. And while I was down in Santa Fe, my friend Tom took me up into the mountains one day to see a Vietnam Veterans Memorial up by Angel Fire. And I couldn't get it. I was having trouble with a cell signal up there, so I turned my phone off because it kept looking for a signal and was eating the battery up and everything else. And I got back down later that afternoon and turned my phone back on, and I had a real nasty voicemail from Linda. You know, you don't need to avoid me if you want to go off and play with your friends and da-da-da-da and have to be distracted by me and so on and so forth. And so I examined my behavior, and I called her back, and we had a conversation, and we squared things up because she'd written some inventory in the same time and talked to her sponsor and one of the gals she worked with. And so we'd both exercised this marvelous 10th step of ours. And that becomes very important because a couple days later, I flew back from Santa Fe, and I'll shorten the story up. Long story short, I get back into Indianapolis, and Linda was supposed to pick me up that night at the airport, and she was a reliable woman, and she wasn't there. And I called her, and I didn't get a hold of her. And so I waited a period of time, and then eventually I got a cab and had the cab take me over to her house. And because we're engaged, I had a key to that car house, and I went inside the house and found her collapsed in the bathroom. She'd collapsed with a stroke that morning while getting ready for work. And so we got the paramedics there and began a process of 5 days in neuro-intensive care until the doctors told us there was no hope left and that we needed to go to hospice. I am so grateful. The first thing I could be grateful for in that experience was that she and I didn't have a bunch of unfinished business between us, that we both practiced the principles of this program, and that we were clean. And that I didn't have to stand by her bed and hold her hand as she was dying, going, I wish I'd done this, or I wish I'd said this, or everything else, because it had been said. And more than that, I want to thank you because of what you've taught me and the principles you've given me, that I got to be part of the solution there instead of part of the problem. Linda was about the only recovering member of her family, so we had people that were in various sides between needing AA and needing Al-Anon swarming the hospital and intensive care unit. And instead of being one of the crazy ones, I got to be one of the ones that could support the other family members and help things happen. Not because of my strength, but because of what you've given me and what you've taught me. My dear friend Don taught me years ago, and one of the greatest gifts I've ever gotten around here is how to be in the presence of death without fear and not without losing my mind. And I didn't know I even needed to learn that lesson because I'm a combat veteran of Vietnam. I was in the front edge of that. I was part of I led a platoon of men into the Plain of Reeds one Sunday afternoon, and 3 days later, 32 of us went in. 3 days later, 3 of us came out. I thought I knew about death, but I didn't. Because in those days, what I did is I sat down, and if you'd asked me, I'm sitting next to my friend's body, and if you'd asked me what was going on with me, I'd say, you know, it's okay, it's all cool, man. I don't mean a thing, because I'm shut down. And what I did is I found I spent my life, it's like I had an emotional MasterCard, you know. And as I went through life, I had a choice. I could either experience what was going on and pay the price at the time and have the experience, or I could put it on the card. And you know what I chose to do. I just put it on the card. And I got here, and I couldn't even make the minimum payment on the balance anymore. And so I had people around here that showed me important life skills. See, because sobriety wasn't my solution. Sobriety is my problem. That's what the message that I got that saved my life, because I couldn't understand. I was sitting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all looked like you were enjoying this and having a good time. And I'm dying inside with a smile pasted on my face. And I remember when he said to me, he says, oh, Mike, he said, you know, he He says, sobriety is not your solution. It's your problem. You've been sober hundreds and thousands of times. He says, you can't stand life sober. That's why you go back to drinking. The idea is, how do you get a meaningful sobriety that's sufficiently comfortable and tolerable for you that you can wear it and stay in it and live in it? And that's where we are here. I was so blessed by that woman. I could stand up and take all of my time. I won't telling you about her, but I think probably if I had, I was thinking of what could I tell you in a sentence that would describe Linda. We were having a conversation one time, and she turned to me. We sometimes did these workshops and retreats together and so forth. And she turned to me with this big smile on her face, and she says, Mike, she says, since we have resentments where we re-feel and re-experience anger, she says, do you suppose that it would be possible for us to have re-lovements where we can re-experience the love that we've been given and the love we've experienced and the love we didn't even, that was given to us that I didn't even know was love at the same time? And so she was one of my teachers that walked through my life, I miss her terribly, but she also gave me the tools to move on without her, as my other teachers have. Clint and Don. I was having a moment, I heard Linda talking to me, and the first time she talked to me, she said, she says, Mike, you need to know I don't need you to grieve me. I need you to be happy. And my heart knew that came from her. And then some weeks later, I was in anguish, and I said, oh, God, I'll never love anybody like I loved you. And I heard her laugh, and she says, well, of course not, silly. You've already done that. And so we go on. And thank God for the examine. God could and would if he were sought. And these are God's seeking steps. The same way I used to seek out that alcohol or score whatever I was going to do, I need to be have that thirst and that hunger for God today. One of the things I like best about my home group is that we have what we call, it's not formally structured, but we have 10-step circles in there. And we have a real tradition of 10-stepping with each other in there. And part of that tradition is that you 10-step with the new guys so they see how the old-timers get it done. And one of the guys that changed my life was a man by the name of Gary B., and He was the old guru in the group when I was very new there, and I didn't know what to do. And he grabbed me one day. I'd seen him in a group of people for lunch, and we were walking away. And he grabbed me as I was headed back to my car, and he said, Mike, I need to tell you about something that I did at work this morning. And he went ahead and explained to me that he'd taken credit for a sale that should have gone to another salesman who wasn't there that day, and so forth, and that he was here. He says, I think I'm going to go see the boss, and I'm going to own up with the boss and tell him what's going on. And then I'm going to, you know, he laid out his whole plan of action. And then he said, you know, before the meeting tonight, why don't you, can you meet me down at the Salvation Army? Let's see if we can talk to a couple drunks down there. And he gave me a important lesson. First of all, I didn't hear somebody tell me about how I should live Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the oldest member of my group go to one of the youngest members of the group and humble himself and lay out, says, look, here's what I did. Here's the mistake I made. Now, he could have gone to his sponsor, Paul, or he could have gone to any number of people. But he went. I was one of the people he went to, and I'll tell you, it made an impact on my life. And then he also demonstrated that often forgotten part of our 10th step, you know, that we need to turn our thoughts to somebody else we can help. What I find with this 10th step is what I have here is if I choose to, I get to participate in God's recycling plan. See, I go out here and I'm trying to live life the best I can. I've always had a life full of good intentions. I suspect you did too. We mean well. But I get caught up in my ends and means, and I'm frightened, and so I take my good intentions and I create garbage. And if I will take them and simply put them into the program process and into God's hands, God recycles my garbage back into something that can help somebody else if I'll allow it to happen. I'll share with you a couple of, few weeks ago, when the gas prices were still astronomically high, I was at Costco pumping gas, and the attendant came over and said, "Sir, please don't top off your tank." And I turned to him and I said, "Look, buddy," I said, "the day you start putting your credit card in that machine, you can tell me how to pump the gas. Until then, by God, I'm pumping it the way I want to." Yeah. I mean, it's times like these, I'm so happy that there is no "I'm a friend of Bill W." bumper sticker on the back of my car. See, my anonymity is not for me, it's for you. And I hadn't even got the pump back on the hook. And of course, because you've awakened me, I knew I was wrong. It just felt wrong. And so what I did is I immediately went to that gentleman and I said, "You know, I had absolutely no right to talk to you that way. That was completely disrespectful. And you're standing out here in this wind and cold and trying so we can get gas and help us. And I'm sincerely sorry that I was disrespectful to you that way. Please accept my apologies." And we started a conversation. We did. I immediately, when I left there, I got on my phone and I called the newest guy that I'm working with. And I told him exactly what his sponsor had just done. And that's the way we work, and it turns out to be a very effective way to do things. See, the image that was given to me, I got here because I was picking all my knowledge of StepWorks and our program up out of what I heard in meetings. I'd hear something in this meeting over here, and I'd repeat it in that meeting over there if I thought it sounded good. And so I didn't have a program. What I had was a collection of sound bites. And I just lost my train of thought. I don't know. So the man that explained this to me in a way that made sense to me, you know, because I thought 10th step, okay, I sit and I do the 10th step at night before I go to bed. That's what I do, is I'll do my 10th step at the end of the day, and I review my day and all that kind of stuff. And he said, "Well, Mike, let me ask you this." He says, "Suppose I was walking my dog, and I walked past your house and my dog made a deposit on your lawn." He says, would you like it if I came up to you and said, "Well, look, you'll be happy to know I'm part of a spiritual program, and I'm going to think about this later today. And if I decide that my dog shouldn't have dumped on your lawn, I may come back tomorrow or the next day and clean it up. How would you feel about that?" "No." He says, "What about if I immediately told you I was sorry about what my dog had done and I cleaned up the mess right on the spot? Would you like that better?" "Uh-huh." So this whole 10th step business is about the here and now. The spiritual life is not, as was mentioned yesterday, the spiritual life is happening right here, right now, in this moment. It's the only place God and I can meet together. And so the adjectives in the 10th step, we ask God at once You know, doesn't mean, I was told that, by the way, it doesn't mean he delivers it at once, but my job is to ask it once. So I ask it once. I make amends quickly. I do quickly at once all of this stuff. I do this stuff rapidly. I don't waste time with it. And then I turn my thoughts to somebody else I can help. And if I do that, I get to be part of God's recycling program. And I don't think it's any accident that the 10-step promises are such a wonderful set of promises. And they tell me by this time, you know, I'm going to seldom think about alcohol. And that I'm going to actually, this is the point where a sane life starts to happen for me again. And can't you imagine it? What would be a saner life of me going along, me out there living with my best intentions, I'm going to make mistakes and I'm going to clean it up right here, right now. And as I told you, that's borne so much fruit in my life. This whole business of self-examination and inventory is so important that we get asked to do it in any number of places in our program. Obviously in the 4th step, the 10th step, the 11th step. And inventory at all levels is so important that I didn't really have a 1st step that I could hang on to until I got a 4th step. And I'll share with you just quickly where my 1st step came from, where I really understood it. And maybe it'll be of some use to you. This is a piece of conduct inventory I wrote about the love of my life, the woman, my college sweetheart, the guy, the girl I wanted to marry, and the one woman I wanted to have my children with. And it's not long. Her name was Ellen. Where was I selfish? I wanted to enjoy sex with her regardless of the consequences. Where was I dishonest? I told her not to worry, that I'd always be there for her no matter what. I dishonestly refused to consider my ability and willingness to keep that promise. I was inconsiderate. I gave no consideration of the consequences to her of my behavior to her family, her faith, her reputation, and her career. I aroused jealousy. Told her if she didn't have sex with me, that I'd get it elsewhere. I paid an undue attention to other women in her presence. I told her how attractive I found them. That's a nice way to treat the woman you love. I aroused suspicion. I often spent time alone with other women, and she found me at Holly's apartment. Bitterness. When she became pregnant, I told her I doubted that it was my child, told her that I was too young to get married and didn't want to marry her anyway. And when she was in California having our baby, I made drunken phone calls to harangue her. And I abandoned her and our child. And because I was back home in the Midwest and she was in California, I was the one that's telling the story. Look at, she abandoned me. Who did I harm? Well, I harmed the baby, obviously, Ellen, her family, my family, and our friends. What should I have done instead? Don said, well, almost anything would be an improvement. And this became the foundation for the 1st. I've got others since, but my 1st ideal for my conduct here is that I should have treated sex as a sacred gift that it is. I shouldn't have engaged in behavior that I wasn't willing to be responsible for. I should have honestly faced the consequences of my action. I should have been honest with myself and others. My harms were all rooted in dishonesty, particularly about how afraid I was. Self-reliance will always produce fear and pain. And see, I got the 1st step because this is where I got a 1st step, because I understood that I loved this woman so much that if I could have treated her any other way, I would have. This was the best I could do with the person I loved most on my power, putting everything I had into the effort. This is the best I could do. And I looked at it, and my spiritual awakening at the time was understanding that I could keep trying the rest of my life, but it was always going to be some version of this story as long as I did this on my will. And if all I'd done is just not drink, and if you hadn't encouraged me and forced me to pick up a pen, I would have never gotten anchored in this. I mean, obviously, amends flowed out of that and other things. But that was the foundation years later that allowed me to have a loving relationship with a woman like Linda. And have that woman look at me and tell me she loved me and she wanted to spend her life with me. What a gift. And it all began with the disappointment of my ego. We move into the talk a bit about step 11 here. I'm not going to try and give you techniques or anything like that here. I'm going to just maybe tell you a few stories about my experience. And one of the beautiful things that happened here as I approached this is the people that revolutionized my life in this area. They would give me what seemed like vague outlines and point me maybe in different directions and pick me up when I fell down a little bit, but they would never. I remember asking Don. I said, you know, well, tell me, get more specific. Tell me about your God. And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. He says, if I do that, he says, what you'll do? He says, you're a spiritual thief. He says, what you? No. If I lay out my experience for you in that depth, he says, what you'll do is you'll just simply take my experience and you'll never have your own. And it never really will be your own. So I can point to directions, I can give you some guidance and stuff like that, but you need to have your own experience. I remember at one of those moments that we had so much fun together. I'm going, Don, I don't think God's going to work for me. And he looked at me and he says, well, why should he? And I got another old idea. See, I thought God was supposed to work for me. Hello, you know. As a matter of fact, Don kind of, he kept smiling more and more. And I kept getting the idea, oh, you mean it's the other way around, huh? And that's what a spiritual awakening is like. And that's what the sweet teacher is like for me. I actually found my conception of God by doing a piece of inventory. And I won't bore you with all of that, but I'll show you how that process works. Because, see, the beginning of the solution of any problem I've got begins with the acknowledgement that I'm powerless in what Mike's bringing to the party to try and fix this isn't working. And I don't need to spend days or weeks or months on that. And likewise, I can very quickly, do I believe spiritual help's available to me with this problem? Am I willing to ask for spiritual help? Am I willing to examine my behavior? Am I willing to take this and place this in God's hands and follow the direction that I'm given there? I don't need to spend months or weeks working on this. It happens in a flash. We've had several people with legal educations talk to us this weekend. I mean, every profession, every discipline has got their problem-solving method. There's a legal problem-solving method that the way the lawyer will walk through the problem. Well, that we have a spiritual problem-solving method, and it's our 12 steps. And so whether it's an expanded version or very quickly, we're always operating on the same principles here. This was not my first inventory, and I'll tell you, with any of this, if I was writing it again today, I'd write it neater, better, and all that kind of stuff. I'm alive because I was willing, and people let me write inadequate, bad inventory. But it was good enough to get me to the next step in the road. And this was an inventory that I resisted writing because, for a whole variety of reasons, but another man named Mickey said, look, if you don't write this inventory, just quit calling me. I don't want to hear about it anymore. And so I wrote the inventory. And the inventory, the reason I wrote it was about all the ways at this time that I was resenting and hating myself. And I didn't want to write the inventory because I'm a smart guy. I know that means I'm eventually going to have to make amends to myself. And I've heard those guys in the meetings that talk about making amends to themselves. Oh, I hurt myself worse than anybody else, and so I'm going to get myself a new Porsche instead of paying my child support, you know. I don't want to be that guy. It's my image, and so I'm not going to write the inventory. But I write the inventory here because Mickey drove. Here I am in the first column, second column. I'm unable to be a true friend. I gossip. I only pretend to care about you. My mind's always fixed on me. Watch your wife or girlfriend around me. What's this effect? Well, my self-esteem, because I don't respect my own behavior. Imagine that. My security's lacking because I assume other people either like me and don't really care, or they're better than I am because they do. I built myself a box where I'm screwed either way. Affects my personal and sex relations because I'm always looking for my own pleasure and trying to manipulate other people for my benefit. Even the so-called good things I do are done to impress others or benefit me and manage and control how other people see me. My mistakes, unwilling to trust God, demand to be the center of attention, and goes on. Found an old idea there. Why was I chasing your wife or your girlfriend? I was actually trying to steal some self-esteem. If I can be loved by somebody you want, I can steal a little self-worth. Not terribly functional, but it worked. I come from a tradition, and because I'm an alcoholic, by the way, anytime I do in the slightest bit of work, I want the maximum benefit out of it. I mean, if you want to mess with an alcoholic's mind, let him think he may have done some unnecessary work. I mean, it just drives us crazy. And so I fifth-stepped that material with Mickey and everything else, and that was okay. But again, I took that back to Don, and Don heard something else in there because there was page after page of stuff like that. And he said, "Mike, I hear there in every one of those fourth columns, it's some version of unable or unwilling to trust God, unable or unwilling to trust God." He says, "Mike, since I know you a little bit." He says, "I believe you're a man who'd truly like to trust God. So if you're not trusting God, there must be something blocking you. Let's see if we can find out what it is." And what had happened, I went into some consideration and talked to Don a day or two later. And what I'd gone to, at that time I was operating with a vision of God as God the Father. And as I wrote and thought about this, I realized I admired my father. My father was my one of my biggest heroes. I loved the man. But what I came to is I came back to a place and I saw myself sitting at the kitchen table with my dad when I'd come back from Vietnam, and I'd been back for maybe 6 months or a year now, and I was partying because I was entitled to. And my dad was I resemble my mom. My dad was a big football player, went to college on a scholarship as a tackle at Drake University. And so, tackles in the 30s weren't as big as they are today, but he was a big man. And, there's that big man sitting in front of my powerful hero, and he's got, there's a pile of my bad checks between us. And my dad's got tears in his eyes, and he says, "Son, I love you more than I can begin to tell you." And he says, "I would do anything in the world to help you, but it seems like the more I help you, the worse you screw up. What am I going to do with you?" And see, because I was operating with what had been a good conception up to then of God the Father, I heard God saying to me, "Mike, look at all I've given to you. I've saved your life in Vietnam. I've given you careers. I've given you relationships. I've given you money. I've given you this. I've given you that. And you keep screwing up. What am I going to do with you?" See, what was perfectly appropriate for my earthly father to tell me was something that blocked me from a real relationship with that power greater than myself. And one of the things I'd gotten taught along the way, by the way, was that conceptions are important. Conceptions rather than concept, because conceptions can be changed. Concepts can't. So my conception is very important, but I want to hold on to it loosely. A description a man used that made sense to me, he said, he was a man from India. He says, if I want to go visit my friend in the next village, I will get on my donkey and ride to the next village. But if I want to go into my friend's house and visit him, I must dismount from my donkey. So that which carried me on the journey at some point is the thing that prevents me from completing the journey if I insist on hanging on to it. So that's part of what I need to do and stay fresh around here. And where step 11 becomes so important to me. How do I stay fresh? How do I stay in consciousness of what has carried me as far as it's going to carry me now? And I need to dismount and I need to learn something new in order to move on and continue to grow and be useful in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that became the vision. What I got is I'm a guy that needs things simple. So I had to come up with, I came up with what I call my four pillars, the four points that my relationship with God sits on today. It's a conception. It may change. But in a general way, the most important thing for me to have in that conception is that God's not angry. I don't know about you, but I'm not going to really open myself up to an angry person. Would you? How intimate are you going to be with somebody where you're never going to be good enough? You're always failing. You're always behind the eight ball. So it was absolutely vital for me at the beginning of everything to know that God wasn't angry with me. And so that's the cornerstone. The next piece was that God doesn't think comparatively. God loved me just as much when I'm standing in a liquor store writing a bad check to buy a bottle of whiskey to go seduce the neighbor's wife as he does when I'm down at Salvation Army holding out my hand to the newcomer. Now, make no mistake, I get different consequences according to which of those things I'm doing. But that's not God punishing me. That's just me getting the consequences of my actions, you know. I don't know why I thought God was punishing me all the time. I was just experiencing the natural and normal consequences of my actions. So God's not angry. God doesn't think imperatively. And then one of the questions that revolutionized my life was simply this. Mike, what would your life look like if you took the position that God wants your happiness more than you do yourself? I don't know about you, but I never thought of God as wanting me to be happy. I thought God wanted me to be good. God wanted me to work hard. God wanted me to help you. Everything. I never thought of God primarily as just wanting me to be happy. Now, that's the relationship I'll show up for. You know, oh, you want me to be, I'll be over at your place in a hurry. And then finally, on the other side of that, simply, the final piece is, would it be possible that God might know what would make me happy more than I do myself? And that's where all these stacks of inventories came in. I looked at that and I said, yeah, here it is. This is, if you want to boil this inventory down, it's 40-odd years of me doing the best I can to make me happy. And I've failed utterly, and I've harmed others. I start out with good intentions, and I end up as a man that terrifies children. I turn into somebody that I can't look at in the mirror. So yes, I'm willing to buy that God might know what would make me happy more than I do myself. And they gave me the other piece there that pointed out it should have been obvious, but it said, Mike, there's a difference between happiness and pleasure. See, and I always had conflated those two things. There's a word for Peggy. What I didn't understand is that pleasure is like me just mainlining a pint of Häagen-Dazs, you know, and it's going to feel real good, but there's going to be a price to pay for it on the other side. And happiness, true happiness, there's no downside. There's no consequence to happiness that's on the downside. Happiness fills me up. It sustains me. There isn't a price to pay for the happiness. So I moved on. I was blessed by a experience when I had probably 60 days in my pre-step working days here. I'd gone to one of those meetings that I told you about, and there was a man who had an attractive message in that meeting. His name was Jim, and Jim would always begin his whatever he'd say, "Hi, my name is Jim," and he says, "I'm a devout 11th stepper," and nobody else seemed to talk like that, and I paid attention to Jim. And I, of course, being who I was at the time, I noticed Jim had a corporate jet and flew around and had businesses in Mexico and Switzerland and so forth. And so Jim was attractive to me for any number of reasons. But I thought, well, if this 11th step's so important to Jim, maybe I ought to try it. So I went home to this little apartment I'm in at the time, and I got in my easy chair, and I got out the 12 and 12 and read the 11th step in there and read the St. Francis prayer, and something happened. I don't know. I went somewhere, and I came back. And a couple days later, I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and I noticed the guy across the table from me is firing up a cigarette. And it hit me. Oh, my God. See, I'm the kind of smoker that annoys other smokers. I'm a 3-pack-a-day, you know, just hope-to-die cigarette smoker. I've made no decision to quit, and I haven't had a cigarette in 3 days. They're in my pocket, but I haven't reached for one in 3 days. And the only thing that's happened was that little experience, whatever it was, in the chair. Now, immediately, I'm horrified, and I borrowed a cigarette from the guy. And I began smoking rapidly. But see, I got a clue that, wow, there's some real power available here. And so I did what every good alcoholic would do. I ran back home, got in my chair, got the 12 and 12. I think I put on the same pair of blue jeans, and I don't know if I could I don't know if I could find the same pair of underwear, but whatever. I'm going to recreate the experience. And nothing happened. And I smoked for another couple of years. But what happened here in the significance of all that is God had given me a free sample. He'd shown me that there was the power available in our 11th step was real, it's tangible, and it's not just kind of la-di-da for people who want to get extra credit and brown nose the teacher in AA. This is where the real deal is. And then he did another loving thing, see, because he wouldn't let me, with my own power, recreate that experience and manage it. Because if I could create and manage that experience there, who'd be God? You know, I wouldn't need God. I'd just, you know, he'd be a subcontractor there. And that reminds me, that whole deal about, you know, whether God likes me according to how I'm behaving. Just think about it. If I can change whether God likes me or not by how I'm acting, again, who's God? I can make him like me. I can make him not like me. I can, you know, give me a break. See, my mind's always trying to take me back to that place where I'm playing God. The solution to all these problems keeps coming up. You know, okay, whether it's at the office, whether it's in a relationship, everything else. Where have I tried, with good intentions, of course, but where have I been trying to play God here? know. Let's see, where am I? Another important thing that Don told me, he said, took care of another one of my old ideas. He says, Mike, he says, you need to know that God's a gentleman and he won't change you without your permission. And that was important for me too. Because I was so afraid in this thing. What am I going to be like if I turn my will and my life over the care of God? What will my life look like if I'm on the spiritual path? You know, will I ever get laid again? I mean, you know, well, I'm sorry, but you know, am I going to make any money? I mean, you know, how am I going to? I need my Starbucks. I got on this path, and as I woke up, one of the things in my home group that we do to begin our meetings now, and that started helping me, is we start our meetings with a 5-minute meditation, and we find the quality of the meetings when we do that are much better than the quality of the meetings when that somehow doesn't happen. We're all starting from a better place here. I'm going to run out of time, so I want to tell you about the most important prayer that has come to me, or maybe the most important prayer that's come to me in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got there, not surprisingly, again, through a piece of inventory. As part of managing my life, when I got here in my junior guru phase in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got into the perfect AA marriage, you know, and I even had my sponsor perform the marriage ceremony because I thought that would give me some insurance on how the marriage was going to go, and it turned out not. I identified so much with Ralph's courage yesterday. See, I found myself at 7 years sober living in a sleeping bag on the floor of the den of my best friend after my wife had put me out of the house. This was not what my AA image wanted to be around here. We went ahead and we got that divorce, and it was respectful and so forth. And so I got to start seeing my... Shortly after we said that, I got to start spending time with my son, Andrew. And one night, I'd have him usually for a long week, and I'd have him Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and take him to school on Monday morning. And so Friday night, Andrew comes to me, and he says, Mike, he's 6 at the time, and Andrew says, Mike, he says, I'm tired of McDonald's and all those kids' places and Applebee's and everything. He says, would you take me to a grown-up restaurant tonight? I said, sure, Andrew, I'll do that. So I take Andrew to a grown-up restaurant. And we're going along and we're having fun. And all of a sudden, I start looking around. And I'm here with a 6-year-old, and I'm surrounded by couples in love. And and the wave of self-pity tsunami just hits me. Everybody else here is sitting there and they're in love, and I'm with the 6-year-old. God, you know, it's a, now you've taught me how to behave by this time. So I treat my boy right, and we finish our meal and go home, and we watch the video, and I give him a bath and put him to bed and everything else. But as soon as his little butt hit that mattress, I got my pen out and I'm writing, you know, and I'm mad. I am hot, and I am mad at God. And I was taught that I could, you know, part of any real relationship, you know, if you can't be angry with somebody, you don't have a relationship. And so because now I've got a relationship with God, I can get angry with God. And I don't have to do that in a fearful way. But So here's the little inventory that came out of that. First column, who do I resent? God. Why? Well, because I don't have the relationship I want to have with a woman. I think God's going to only give me the choice between having a sick relationship or no relationship. You're cruel. I'm lonely. People that I sponsor are having better relationships than I am. It gets better. I'm afraid that God will keep me in this pain because I will be more useful to others this way than if I have the relationship that I've been. It's like, yeah, get down off the cross, Mike. We need the wood. I feel like God has given me the gift of communication with others, and the price of the gift is my own happiness. I'm mad because I know only God can help me, and I don't believe He will. And anyway, I didn't know I was going to be reading that from here when I wrote it. Thank God. Apparently, some people identify though. Well, what's it affects? It affects my self-esteem because I feel like I'll sell out my principles to have a comfortable relationship. In fact, I might do something like hit on a newcomer. As a result, I feel like a phony. Don says, that's because you're a phony. It's distorted my sex relations. I came up with my solution to my sex life at this time and post-divorce. I did what all the major corporations were doing. I decided to outsource my sex life. And so what I did was I entered into a sex-only relationship with a woman who is not in Alcoholics Anonymous. No dates, no movies, no flowers, no dinners. We just emailed or called and made appointments for racquetball. And it says, I'm engaged in this increasingly emotionally unsatisfying sex-only relationship. I'm starting to buy porn again. Affects my personal relationships and keeps me jealous of others and comparing myself and coveting what they have. I'm absolutely unwilling to share my pain about this. I feel ashamed apart from flawed and different. My unbalanced drive in this area makes me vulnerable to getting drunk. Compromising my principles will get me drunk, and I know that I don't have the strength not to do this on my own. My mistakes here. I'm not willing to give this to God because I don't think He's interested or willing to help me. God doesn't care about my sex life. God doesn't care whether I have a woman in my life. I'm absolutely willing to sell out my principles for relief. I'm impatient. I'm not willing to take an honest look at what this fantasy relationship isn't going to do for me. And I'm looking for somebody else to fill me up and make me feel safe and secure, and only God can do that. If I was in a relationship, I'd be misusing it at this point. This is all the same night. I'm on the phone, and I call the old timer in my home group, and I call Gary up, and I read it to him, and then I start working my way west across the time zones, and I get a hold of Don, and I read that to Don, and you know, he's got some comments. Well, like you said, well, yeah, you're a phony. And he says, well, Mike, he says, you know, you don't want Miss Wright. You want Miss Wright now. And he said, what I want you to do, and here's where my, it's, Clancy talked sections and inches, you know. This is a pivot point for my life, and this is, what, 16 years ago now. He says, Mike, I want you to do this and just this. He says, I want you to start praying a prayer, and the prayer is just this. God, please teach me about love. He says, you know a lot about sex. You don't know anything about love. And so it was almost like a throwaway, and I called a guy in California then to see if I could get a different answer. And but I loved Don and I trusted Don, so I followed his direction. And I got part of my deal with him is that if I did what he suggested and I didn't like the results, I could call him back and complain. So about 2 weeks later, I called Don up and I says, Don, I says, you need to know I don't think much of your damn prayer. And he says, well, what's wrong, cowboy? And I says, well, since I started saying your prayer, it was his prayer then, since I started saying your prayer, the only woman I was really interested in got a job transfer and left town. And on top of that, I went to see my doctor the other day, and he gave me some blood pressure medication that's made me impotent, you know. And he says, I think you misunderstood the prayer. He says, the prayer wasn't God get me a woman. He says, the God teach me about love. Work with me on this. And so I continued to pray the prayer and live a life in meditation. And a wonderful thing happened. I fell absolutely head over heels, completely in love with my son. Now, I'd always loved him, but he and his mother had always had a little something different going than what he and I had going. And there was just like a, there was some kind of a wall or barrier, I don't know what. But it went away. And I just loved my son wildly, and I do to this day. And we have a wonderful time. He's a great kid. Don loved him, by the way. Don had come to town, and Don had go over in the corner with Andrew, and he'd come back shaking his head. He's, that boy is a very old spirit, Mike. Pay attention to him. He's 4 years old. I pick him up at daycare, and I'm bringing him home, and he turns to me, and I was talking about something. He says, Mike, you know, it seems to me your life might work better if you said the second thing that comes to your mind, you know? My ex-wife told me, you know, she made amends to him. She says, Andrew, I'm sorry that my inability to have a stable relationship with a man has caused such chaos in your life. And he looked at her and he said, Mom, he says, I think it's been a lot harder on you than it's been on me. And the next thing was I fell in love with that ex-wife again. I didn't want to marry her again. But what happened is God restored her to the place she had in my heart before we got married. And what happened was that Lori and I were two people that met in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were well suited to being each other's really good friend. But we're alcoholics, so marriage sounded like it was more. And what happened was God just restored us to that place of friendship. And that exists to this day. So year after year, the prayer has unfolded in new and different ways. I get to have a new meeting to that prayer. I met Linda in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I met her in a different way. She and I had been friends for a lot of years before we became romantically involved. We were both with other people. Her husband was a good friend of mine, And he died suddenly and with a very vicious attack of pancreatic cancer that killed him in 3 months' time. And I got to watch her care for him as he was dying. And I got to share a home group with her for a number of years. And I was really astounded when I'm in the parking lot. We'd had a weekend workshop at the home group. And can you imagine, I'm standing in the parking lot and Linda comes up to me. And this gorgeous woman comes up to me and she says, Mike, I love you. And I said, well, I love you too, Linda. And she says, no, I really love you. And she says, how about a hug? And so I give her a hug. She says, no. She says, I don't want that agape hug from you. I want a real hug, you know. And it didn't start out of lust or anything like that. We started from a place of love and mutual respect and so forth. And we got to practice these principles. And she became one of my teachers too. Because I realized I had a rule that only certain people were allowed to teach me things, and I was missing learning a lot by limiting the number of people that I allowed to teach me things. And she did things to me like she came up to me shortly after we became romantic. She came up to me and she says, "Mike," she says, "I've written out the primary purpose for our relationship here." She says, I want to see yours, you know. And I, oh God, you know, you want it in writing. So I did what I did. I did it. Came back. She used to stand at the podium. She said that her primary purpose for our relationship was so specific that it described the color, weight, and clarity of the diamond I was supposed to purchase, and. And mine was so vague that it could have covered my relationship with my cat. But see, around starting from those two, that's probably about the poles. Starting from those poles, we get to form a common purpose that provides a stable foundation for the relationship. And we did that. One of the things we did, she suggested we'd sit on the couch side by side frequently, and we'd just hold hands and we'd take turns talking out loud to God. Now, it's really hard when you're sitting there holding her hand and talking to God to spin it that it's her fault. It's just a little thing, but it was one of the ways. She said, "Would you be willing to try this with me? Just to see if we can start building the foundation of a spiritual life." And we tried all kinds of things, and we meditated together, and we had a wonderful time. And it wasn't always a smooth road, but because of the teachers that we both had, we learned how we could turn our problems into assets that we actually grow stronger in the broken places. If we will take those things and place them in God's hands. So when she died, I was sure that that the prayer had come to an end. I'd acted appropriately and so forth, but she was gone. And matter of fact, I thought that the prayer had actually turned into a cruel joke. Am I ever going to be able to talk about this again? Teach me about love. How could you do this to me? I get the real deal and you take it away. And then I found out that the sky opened again, and see, my next lesson is to accept the love of you, because when she died, all of you were all over me, loving me and everything else. And you see, I realized that I had an old rule that I'm the dispenser of love, not the recipient of it, you know, because I felt much safer that way. And I found out it took real courage to let you love me, because I'm much more vulnerable then. What if you decide to stop loving me? It's better just to keep you at arm's length in the first place. So I had to let you in, and I had to let you love me. And I've learned time and time the lessons go on every day in terms of conscious loving. I was doing something this summer. I had a practice suggested to me. He said, Mike, would you be, a friend of mine said, Mike, would you be willing to give God just 1 minute out of every hour you're awake in the day? I mean, does that sound like a lot? Could you, you say God's everything. Would you be willing to give God a minute every hour? So Oh, yeah, I can do that. So I start doing that, and I'm doing it for a couple days, and then I get a call from my friend Annette, and she's working that day, and she's having a migraine attack come on. I says, don't worry about it. I says, I'm already spending time with God every hour. I will, you know, you're going to be the focus of my meditation the rest of the day. And so I start out, I'm going to consciously love and hold Annette up in meditation. And that goes well for 2 hours. And the third hour, I sit down and I start to meditate for Annette and her migraine and everything else. And you know, if she'd take better care of herself, she wouldn't have these problems. You know, the way she drinks caffeine, I mean, it's no wonder that she, you know. And like you, see, I get to laugh at myself. Because God, all that God did is just reach over and give me a little nudge and say, hey, Mike, what you've got is a good idea and a good intention. You just don't have the power to make this happen on your own. So I guess if I've given you anything today, I hopefully a little experience, a couple laughs at my expense, and maybe an inkling that there's a lot to explore and enjoy here on this. This is the realm of the Spirit, and it's broad, roomy, and all-inclusive, and room for all of us, and there's always more to learn and more to do here. I want to close up here with something I have found in Linda's effects as I was executing my responsibilities to her estate. Here, I think I have it here. Maybe not. Yeah, we're not supposed to do that. Got too much paper here. Well, apparently, Linda and her spirit have intervened and decided not today. So I will simply leave you by asking that you just please remember me as loving you. Thank you very much.